There are a few people missing. Okay, I think enough people are here now. And if those people are late, it's just bad karma means they miss out being enlightened at this time. They have to come back again. So, carrying on with the meditation instructions, you know, just on the breath meditation, I was mentioning yesterday that the breath is what is the focus of your attention when you, what you notice, for those first four stages. And of course, it's, you just notice the breath. What you see, first of all, is not very much, just an in and out. And then it gets more aware as your mindfulness increases, so you can see much more of what's going on, until you get to, we call, the full awareness of the breath, from the very beginning to the end of a breath, and the spaces in between. That's called watching the whole of the breath. And then, of course, you calm it down. It calms down naturally. I shouldn't say you calm it down, but then it calms down. These are all natural progressions. Whatever you watch, first of all, you just see a little bit of it. But as you sustain your attention on something, you start to see more and more and more and more and more. And as you see more and more and more of the breathing, you can see just the whole of it. And because you're being peaceful, because you're not doing very much, mindfulness increases its energy. You can see more, and what you see is more beautiful. Those two always go together. Stillness, seeing more, and beauty. And, or delight, joyfulness, or whatever. And it is, of course, the joyfulness, the delight, which is the free gift on a meditation retreat. You know, we come here to maybe to relax, to be peaceful, to get insight, to understand Buddhism. And sometimes it's quite surprising that you also get happiness. Sometimes people don't realize that that's what they get in these retreats. And it's such a beautiful happiness that keeps people coming back more and more. And because it's a happiness retreat, because this way of meditation does increase your happiness, it also brings the side effects of good health, energy, and you're enjoying meditation. So religion doesn't have to be a painful experience where you're told you're going to go to hell, where you have to sit down and listen to boring sermons for hour after hour after hour, because that's what you're supposed to do. When I was young, that's one of the reasons I turned off things like Christianity. Crikey, just listening to that for an hour, just a lot of rubbish being said, and just being scared that, you know, if I don't give a donation, I'll burn in hell, and they describe what hell is like to you. It's just, it's abuse. But anyhow, just, it's very nice that maybe because I went through that, being bored by sermons, especially when you're in school, someone gave a sermon at school, it was really boring. Because of that, then maybe that's my reaction to that, is to tell jokes and funny stories. Because that's my, I was so traumatized by that myself, I don't want to inflict that on anyone, by boring sermons. So anyway, but it also should be informative as well, so. Now you can actually see this practice, it brings back the joy, and you get to this stage of delightful breath, which is where I stopped yesterday. Now, of course, I always say that that's the most, you know, if you want to sort of attain anything, or attaining, or get to any stage in the meditation, once you get to that, then I'm very happy, because the rest usually occurs all by itself. And my job from this point on is to teach you what not to do, how not to interfere with the process, and just let the process evolve, which it happens once you get to the delightful breath. So most of the teachings which I give, most of the instructions and support is just to get you to that delightful breath. Even telling you jokes and funny stories, that's also done not just to entertain you, it's also to bring up this positive mind, a happy mind. Because that is an important part of the meditation. Sometimes it's really strange, for me anyway, that people say, yeah, they can see the whole breath and it's very, very peaceful, but it doesn't have the joy in it. And I realize that in Westerners, and maybe Singaporeans, that we've stopped knowing how to cultivate happiness. We're all so serious, critical, and miserable that little things which we can make other people happy, we just don't even smile and laugh. Now, you may know in olden days, maybe those of you who go to places like Burma, I think Burma's still got it. Bhutan has lost it. It used to be the happiness country, but, you know, I went there, people have stopped smiling so much. Thailand, when I first went there 40 years ago, it was the land of smiles. It's not the land of smiles now. If you go to Bangkok, it's the land of, you know, I want to sell you something, or something like that, or I want to change the government, whatever. But it's not the same as it used to be. People were so easygoing, and they could smile easily. And I think that's one of the reasons why in those days people would get very deep meditation. They weren't afraid of happiness. They had happiness. They knew how to work with happiness. But sometimes when we get happy these days, you know, either we miss it, we can't see it, we're too serious, we're too busy solving problems, we can't just stop and enjoy ourselves. And this is one of the things which I have to encourage, because that is a skill which you need to take you from, you know, the peaceful breath, the delightful breath, to notice happiness. And there's trying to develop little skillful means. Now, one skillful means which I've developed, which sometimes works, doesn't always work, is that when you get to the stage of the, you know, the full awareness of the breath, you know, the breath is there, you haven't got many thoughts going on, you know, you're not asleep, you can see the breath there, you're very peaceful, there's not the happiness there. It is to take your attention away from the breath for a few seconds, put it on your mouth, and smile. Now force a smile on your face. Because as soon as you force a smile on your face, that, you know, goes back to your mind and makes the mind happy. It means it's pointing itself in that direction. And then you go back to the breath, and it actually looks happy now. You're just deliberately developing the perception of happiness just by having a little smile. And if that doesn't work, you know, it means that, you know, that you don't really know how to make yourself happy enough. Yeah, life is miserable sometimes, but, you know, if it's miserable, you might as well smile anyway. It'll still be miserable if you frown. So that is why if you read Good, Bad, Who Knows, I've told people who are unhappy, depressed, angry, miserable, lost their job, going through a divorce, dying of cancer, whatever it is, exercise. 20 push-ups every morning. You know the 20 push-ups? Let's do 5 push-ups, everybody, 5 push-ups. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, in front of a mirror. It makes you laugh and makes you happy. Then you go and meditate. See the difference? And now you think, well, this is silly stuff, but it actually works. It brings out this happiness and this softness in the mind. That's why the teddy bear meditation works. You put a teddy bear on your lap and you meditate. It's a stupid thing to do. You know, see, you think, I did that with it last night. Just because, you know, I've got to teach by example. I'm very glad that no one actually, they probably did when I wasn't watching, take a photo of me and put it on Facebook. Actually, I'm born with this teddy bear. But you do that because what does it do to your mind? It makes it soft, it makes it happy, it brings up joy. And that's such an important thing to start to develop in the meditation. Once you've lit that little spark, that little fire, then it really takes off. So, you know, if I've got a nice peaceful breath, where's the happiness? I just go to my faith, nice smile, go back to the breath. It's like lighting a match. The happiness is there. It's just you're missing it. And by deliberately developing a bit of external happiness, you go into the internal happiness, and then you really, really sort of take off. Your breath is delightful. It starts off just being delightful, then it gets very happy. It's very beautiful. Some of the most wonderful thing you've seen. It's just so peaceful going in and going out. And by developing that perception of beauty with the breath, you may also understand that that is what sticks your attention onto the breath. You're enjoying it. You're having a good time. And as you all know, whatever you enjoy, you don't need to focus on. You don't need to force yourself. You know, it just happens naturally. The mind stays with where it has fun and joy. And if you don't get happiness and joy coming up, of course the mind will wander off. If it hasn't got any happiness with the breath, it will go and find happiness somewhere else. Plans, fantasies, dreams, anything. Because the mind needs happiness. So once you get to that delightful breath, the happiness starts. Great. Now what happens next is the happiness becomes dominant. Now what you notice more than the breath is the happiness with the breath. It is the perception starts to change. And what you're aware of is beautiful happiness. Yeah, you can see it's the breath being happy, but it's the happiness is what you naturally notice. You don't focus on it, it just happens. And by that time you don't really need to do anything, just let it happen. And I mentioned yesterday, you know, the fear, the control can sometimes come up. I know, this is too much for me, or this is out of control, I'm getting happy, and I'm not doing it. Sometimes it's quite fearful when that happens. When it these things occur when you're doing walking meditation, one of the nice stages of walking meditation, you're walking backwards and forwards, you get full awareness of the feet moving, all these amazing sensations. Then it becomes quite delightful, really interesting. You're walking back and forwards and you're really content and happy and a lot of joy. And my story for that, the first year as a monk, used to do walking meditation in one of the Bangkok monasteries after the little service in the morning as a meditation, then it was about an hour before you had lunch. So I had some walking meditation. And you don't have to walk slow. You can walk whatever pace you want to. Because I have seen in some, especially Vipassana retreats, there's a competition for who can walk slowest. You see them sort of, you know, on the red carpets in there. And she's walking too slow, I better slow down too. And we call that, or actually that what one person here called it, because it was a kid, you know, he was with his mother giving alms food at Bodhinyana Monastery. They just popped in here for some reason. And the kid came back to tell me, he said, Ajahn Brahm, in your retreat center, there are zombies. Zombies. Because apparently in the movie Zombies, they walk really slowly. And the kid, not knowing what walking meditation was, for all the people here, there was like a zombie camp because they were all walking very slowly. So from that day on, we call that type of meditation zombie meditation. Apparently there's lots of movies about zombies now. So they're really, you know, they're cool. Apparently it used to be vampires. You know, was it superheroes, vampires, zombies? I don't know what the next one's going to be. Sorry? Godzilla, yeah, that's a super baddie. But anyway, you always have these fads, you know, which we have. But so don't do zombie meditation. Keep it natural. If you do go slow, fine. So I was going very slow because it was natural. And you really get in your own little bubble, just seeing all these incredible movements of just one step. And I was just so happy in my little bubble. And then I heard a sound, like a million miles away. Brahma one soul. But, you know, much softer than that, because you know that sometimes you hear a sound and it's, you know, maybe a kilometre away on a very still day. And that's what it felt like. And then I realized there was a monk shouting in my ear, about this far away. Baba Wang So! Trying to get my attention. But for me, it was like 1,000 miles. Baba Wang So. Because what happened was that I'd forgotten I had to go to a dharma at somebody's house. I hadn't turned up, and they sent this monk to come and get me. And there he was. Baba Wang So, you've got to come to a house. I didn't hear that. He had to go right up to my ear, almost shouting in it. Baba Wang So. And then, of course, as soon as that happens, when you're in these deep meditations, you think, actually, you don't think at all. You just let it go. Baba Wang So. And then something clicked. That, you know, it was a monk talking to me. So I realized I had to turn around, you know, to look at him and listen. And I remember as I turned my head, there were so many different sensations happen when you turn your head. Incredible number of muscle movements just to turn your head all in your neck. And it's fascinating to watch them all. And even though I knew I had to talk to this monk, I just couldn't do it fast. I took about 5 minutes to turn my head around. That's amazing just what happened. Just all these amazing feelings. And it's just so delightful. And after 5 minutes, when I turned around, what? It was a nice experience because I was so peaceful, so calm. You can't, even with the best wood in the world. I just couldn't get out quickly. Fortunately, it was a monk, so he understands what happens when you meditate. You get very still and peaceful. So he didn't scold me. But it was one of those times when I realized just how peaceful you can get and how still you can get. And that's a great sign in your walking meditation or your sitting meditation. You get so calm and still, it's very hard to go up the gears and start moving again. But also when you're doing the walking meditation, if you do a lot of walking meditation, after that stillness, sometimes you're walking along there and you realize you're not doing the walking. The legs are moving. The legs are moving automatically, and you can watch it with mindfulness. Just separate yourself. I'm not telling my legs to move. They just do it by themselves. And that's a very nice little experience of, you know, non-self, where, you know, you don't tell the legs to do anything. They just do it. And that's actually that sometimes people in the army get that experience. They, in the old days when they used to do marching to get from one place to another, except these days the namby-pamby cream puff soldiers, they go in trucks. In the old days you had to walk everywhere, march all night. And people would fall asleep. They'd still be marching. It was amazing you could do that because just they'd been marching so long, the body knew what to do and the mind didn't need to tell it what to do. It's really fascinating when you're there and experiencing something like that, realizing the body does the walking, not you. Totally automatic. And things you thought you were in control of, you're not. But anyway, that gets very pleasant. So once the breath becomes very pleasant, again, you get very, very still. Nothing much can disturb you. And because nothing is disturbing you, you're getting very still. Remember that very important simile or very important way of understanding meditation. When you don't do anything, mindfulness gets stronger, energy goes into the knowing, and it doesn't stop pouring in there. It gets more and more and more. Your awareness starts to get huge. You can see more. Things which you haven't noticed before, you can actually see. You know, the experience or the stimuli which I give here is that when I was a young monk, I used to always, you know, be in huts, small kutis, no electricity. And in those days, it was really easy for me to shave. As a guy, guys know this. But when I go into these hotels, you know, like on the BF Executive Retreat, when I shave my face, you know, to go out to teach you guys, they have all these lights and they have these magnifying mirrors, and it takes me forever to shave my face because I can always see there's always some stubble left. I hate those. Sometimes I deliberately turn off the lights and just shave anyway, so you know, who cares? But you know, women don't understand that problem, men shaving. It takes forever because the light is so strong. You see things you normally miss. And that's like mindfulness. When your mindfulness is so strong, you start to see defilements, little hindrances, which you miss normally. It's very easy to take them out, because your mindfulness is intense. You see everything, and it's joyful as well. And so because of that, the happiness gets stronger and stronger and stronger. You're really getting into very powerful happiness. So you're not watching the breath anymore, you're watching the happiness. And the happiness usually coalesces into what, you know, we call the nimittas, the lights which come up in the mind. And as I keep talking about these nimittas, some of you haven't got those nimittas, you've never seen them before. Some of you have. And I have to teach, because even if you haven't seen them, it's going to happen, and you may not be here, and I want you to know what to do with them. For those of you who have seen them, you know, you also need to know exactly how to work with them, because that is a subtle state of meditation, and you're on the edge of something really great, and it's wonderful that a monk like me can talk to you about those things and how to develop them. So the first thing is, what are they? And for it took me a long time, even though it's right there in the Buddha's teachings, sometimes because it's not emphasized or explained to you, you miss it. Now this is the ninth stage of Anapanasati, you're experiencing the citta. The citta is the word for the mind, the sixth sense. You know, how do you experience a citta? It's like looking at your face in a mirror. This is the image of the citta. And that citta usually appears as a light. But when the light first comes up, it can be complicated, which is one of the reasons why when some people, when their breath starts to disappear, they see like visions of rolling hills or mountains or waterfalls or monasteries or goodness knows what else. There's no end to the complicated nimittas which can come up first of all. But you'll know it's a nimitta because it is, you know, quite clear. And I haven't told you yet, but I told it in one of the talks. It was the first talk after I did my personal retreat, so the Anagarikas heard me say this, was just about, you know, 10 or 15 minutes, you know, before I had to come out of meditation and go to the chanting with all the other monks, which would end my fortnight retreat. I got one of the most weird nimittas I've ever had. Because I was coming out, so psychologically I was like unwinding, getting ready to sort of be with your friends again after 15 days of solitude. And the nimitta which came up, so I was coming out of the meditation, really clear nimitta, really nice colours, was of Garfield the cat in the cartoon. And I burst out laughing. I'd never seen such a stupid, silly nimitta in my whole life. And there was Garfield, and really clear, you know, a little smart and the whiskers and everything. And like a cartoon, you know, it had just the lines and just singles patches of colour. You know, not like a real person where the colours just change slowly in your face. This was Garfield. And as soon as I recognised that, what the hell have I got a nimitta Garfield for? Burst out laughing, and that was the end of my retreat. So you can get nimittas like that. You don't choose them, they just come to you. And I was thinking, why did I get them? I think, okay, I'm just trying to sort of get back to, you know, talking to people instead of being serious and being a solitude hermit. So that's what I reckon, that's where it came from. But anyway, you see these nice, beautiful images. They're clear, they're bright, that's a good sign of a nimitta. So you may see these things. Number one, enjoy them. Because at this time that sometimes people think, no, this is not the right nimitta, I've got to get rid of this and go to something better. And of course, trying to get rid of things just disturbs the mind. Your job is not to want anything, just to be peaceful and just to enjoy whatever comes. So if you get any sort of image like that, just relax. Just be more still, and it usually uncomplicates itself. And the best way of uncomplicating it, this is not something you do, it's something I make you do because I suggest it. All these suggestions, some of the things which I did when I was in meditation, They were really innovative, I thought. Now, afterwards, I say, wow, that was a really good idea. Why did I do that? And then I look back and I realize years and years and years ago, in some talk, Ajahn Chah mentioned that. But I realized that years and years before, when my meditation was not so good, he planted seeds in me. And I didn't really realize what he was up to. I thought, oh, that doesn't make any sense to me, and forgot it. But it lodged in my brain. And when it was needed, when I came to a certain problem in meditation, I knew exactly what to do because I had a good teacher who told me when I didn't know really what I was doing. I remembered it, you know, deep down in the mind. And that's why I've seen that happen to me. That's why I teach these things to you. Even if you may be a long way from nimittas, I don't care, because one day you get those nimittas, and some of the things I say on this retreat, which you thought you'd forgotten, will come up, and it will take you over that obstacle into deeper meditation. Amazing to actually to experience that and to understand how it works. It is brainwashing, but this is very subtle brainwashing and subtle states of mind, and it's incredibly powerful. So, you know, what you to do, always go for the most beautiful part of that nimitta. Something on Garfield's face which is the most beautiful. Or something, I was coming out of meditation, so I never did that. When it was, you know, like landscape. What's the most beautiful part of the landscape? The most beautiful part of a mountain. If you see a monastery, what's the most beautiful part of it? You always go for the most beautiful part. And what you see then, the most beautiful part, becomes more radiant, stronger. And you go for the most beautiful part of that, and that becomes stronger. And soon you get at the, what, you know, the real useful nimittas. Beautiful lights come in the mind, like a flashlight in your face, a car headlight. Simple and bright. The simplicity of it is important. Those other images, they're great, enjoy them, but the simple ones have the power, and bright and brilliant. So those are the nimittas which, you know, take you into the jhanas. And they're incredible once you start doing these things, but be careful, because the other thing which happens, when a nimitta arises, it means you've been doing everything right so far. You've ticked all the boxes, you've been letting go. But how many people, when they get to that stage, they stuff up by forgetting everything they've been told and deciding, right, I've got a nimitta, now I'm going to control it. And of course it goes away then, very quickly. So please, when a nimitta comes up, just leave it. Just watch. And the simile I gave earlier, the still forest pool, is the best. You've got to imagine you're like Ajahn Chah. Or you imagine like you're a paparazzi about to get the shot of somebody. There's only one paparazzi I know. Fortunately, he's not so well at the moment. I've got to do some charting for him today. But he was a photographer for our local newspaper. And nothing much happens in Perth. It's not New York or London. So, you know, he doesn't get much to photograph. He's mostly photographing, you know, some kid who's just, you know, won the school basketball competition or something. But there was a rumor swirling around some years ago that the pop singer Kylie Minogue had had a breakdown and was hiding in Cable Beach Resort in Broome. Now, trying to get some freedom from, you know, the stress of her job. And so that was the rumor going around. And so the editor of this newspaper asked him, do you want to go to Broome, just in case? And Broome is a really beautiful city. You know, there's a resort there. It's a great climate. It's a wonderful place to live. So he took that opportunity straight away. And so he went up there, and he had to try and find out Cable Beach Resort, this exclusive resort in Broome, you know, to see if Kylie Minogue was there. And of course, you can't go up to the desk and say, is Kylie Minogue here? Because it's high class and they'll keep everything a secret. The only way to do it was climb over the fence and crawl through the bush. So this is what he did. And I like the real paparazzi. So it's really exciting when you're doing something like that. And so, you know, he crawled down, he crawled through the bush, didn't know where he was going, and he saw one of the little cabins there. And there was somebody outside, you know, he looked through, you know, the telephoto lens, and it was her. The rumor was true. And he had this one exciting moment of his life to catch Kylie Minogue when no one else knew where she was. And of course, he remembered Ajahn Chah still falls for. If I move, the animals know I'm there. And they will see me, they will know me. So he could imagine himself like Ajahn Chah with the camera. He couldn't move, he couldn't make any sort of, well, not much movement, no noise, because Kylie would see, and she'd run into her cabin, and his one shot of a lifetime would be missed. And he got it, he got several shots because of Ajahn Chah. And it was syndicated all throughout the world. It was like this one day of fame. You know, the Perth photographer who'd caught, you know, he was a paparazzi for a day. He's a very nice guy. But, you know, that he got the photo. So he was so excited. He told me all about it and how the teachings of meditation had helped him in his career as a paparazzi. Because imagine that was you. Kylie! Oops! And as soon as you mentioned that word, you know, she'd hear and run away. And that was it. But I tell that story because that is how you look at limiters. It's like, you know, Elton John. He's at the retreat. And you can see him. Shh, be quiet, calm. Otherwise he'll run away. Or whatever else is famous you like. So, that's how we treat the limiter. It's like we have to be mindful of it without it realizing you're watching. That's a nice way of looking at it. And then it stays and stabilizes. And just like those animals, they play, getting stronger and stronger, more and more joyful. So when it gets to that stage, when it's stabilized, it will grow quite naturally. The difficulty is stabilizing it. Now, sometimes people say, it's happened to me as well, sometimes when a nimitta comes, first time, sometimes it's at a corner somewhere. It's like it's coming to test whether you're ready for it. And if you go looking for it, it will run away. If you try and bring it towards you, you know, it will just disappear. You just have to wait there. And then it just will come to you right in the center. It comes just by itself. You don't have to do anything. Sometimes it comes and then disappears again, and comes and disappears again very quickly. You just wait there, relax, it will soon settle down. If you get excited, get afraid, do anything, that is when it vanishes. And there's other times that it stays in the center, but it moves all around. It's not sort of still. And that was my problem for many years. I always was moving around. How the heck do I get this still? And again, it was a similar I got from shaving my face in the mirror. You know, I was shaving my face in the mirror and said, why doesn't this face in the mirror be still? Maybe if I hold the mirror still, then the image will stop moving. And of course, if you hold a mirror still, and you, the one who's looking, is moving, of course the image will not be still. And, you know, that was explained to me what was going on. I was trying to hold the mirror still, my mind still. But it was the one who was watching. That was what had to be still. So when my nimitta was moving all around, I decided the one who was watching is going to be perfectly still. When I stopped moving, my nimitta stopped moving. When I was perfectly still, my nimitta was still. The one who's watching is moving. That is why your nimitta moves. And understanding that was just the key to getting this nimitta perfectly still. And then it grows in strength. The longer it stays there, the more energy builds up, and it gets really intense. Now, somebody said this about 3 months ago to me, or, you know, that round about that time. And I just, when they told me this in an interview, I just laughed because, yeah, I remember that. You know when people say something and you remember the time that you had the same problem? You know, it's like nostalgia. You know, it's meditation nostalgia. Yeah, I remember that. It was really good fun. And that was when the light gets so bright, really bright, you think you're going to go blind. Well, I remember that time. That was so incredibly intense. I can't stand this. I'm going to go blind. And the point is, you're not seeing this with your physical eye. It's a mental image. It can be as bright as it wants. And you never get blinded by the nimitta afterwards, but it feels that way sometimes. So I mention that because if that happens to you, this is not an image you're seeing with your eye. It's a mental image, and it can take as much brightness as possible. Well, as I said the other day, sometimes the happiness was too much for me. I wasn't used to so much happiness. But you know, as a monk for many years, you really get used to pleasure. The inner pleasures of the mind. You get a lot of tolerance for ecstasy. I like saying these jokes, but people think that monks have no fun. You know, you can't have sex, you can't watch movies, you can't watch sport, there's so much stuff you can't do. Why do you do this for? If you get these nimitta stages and start getting some happiness, you know why people like becoming monks and staying as monks, especially the meditating forest monks. We have the great time. So, that happens to you, gets really happy, just let it come. Don't do anything. You just enjoy. And as you enjoy more and more and more and more, the bliss gets more and more and more and more. And you really get into it. So into it that all your body has vanished. If there was a sound, you wouldn't hear it. If someone picked you up, because it was the end of the retreat, you had to go home, but you were in this jhana, we pick you up, we take you to the airport, carry you through immigration and customs, put you in the seat in the aircraft, put on your seatbelt, and you're still there in jhanas. And when you come out of jhanas, you're somewhere over Indonesia somewhere. How do I get here? Now, things like that have sort of happened. There was one fellow, he was, you know, an old disciple here, he's dead now. He was in the British Army in the 50s, early 60s or something. And he had these terrible migraines. And the only way to overcome his migraine was find a dark place, a shed or cupboard or somewhere, sit in there with no light. And he said he'd go right inside his migraine to a place where he couldn't feel it anymore. And he did that because it was the only way of coping. And he didn't realize until he became a Buddhist what he was actually doing. He was getting into a jhana. You know, because he had to. It forced him in there because there was intolerable pain of his migraines before they had, you know, proper medication. And he said on one occasion he was with a group of British soldiers in Germany somewhere. And on the radio they told him, take a break, take a cup of tea. So all his soldiers went to have a cup of tea. He had a migraine. There was a farmyard shed close by, so he went into the shed, you know, to get to a dark place because he had another terrible migraine. So he went into the shed, did his normal thing of going right into the center of it, so he couldn't feel the pain, couldn't feel the body, couldn't feel anything. And his soldiers, he was a sergeant or something, a warrant officer, sorry. His soldiers, you know, when they finished their tea, got in the truck, the lorry, and drove off. And they left him in the barn. Until one said, hey, we've lost our boss. So they all turned around, apparently, and they found him in the shed. And he was totally still. And I've seen this before. They literally picked him up and put him in the back of the truck. And only, you know, 2 or 3 miles down the road, he came out of his, whatever he thought it was, and said, hey, what am I doing in here? I was in a barn. And all that time he never knew any sound of the soldiers coming in, never heard the sound of the truck, never even felt soldiers pick him up and put him in the back of a truck. Now soldiers aren't that sensitive, delicate people. They just pick you up and dump you in. He never felt anything at all. And when he told me that, you know, I said, okay, yeah, that's the sort of jhana stuff. And later on in life, this happens in medicine, sometimes these things like migraines, they just disappear, no one really knows why. And so he didn't have the migraines in the latter part of his life, and he also never had the jhanas either. He said, well, I like not having the migraines, but I still wish I could do that meditation like I did when I was in great pain. But that actually showed you what can actually happen, and what these jhanas are really like. You go in with bliss, and you're so blissed out, you know, more than you could ever expect. And you can't feel anything in your body. You can't hear. You know, you can't see, you're just, the five senses are turned off. But you're really sort of having the time of your life. Totally enjoyable. And number two, because many people are afraid. If I can't feel the body, you know, what happens if the roof falls in? And what happens if I can't hear? What happens if it's the fire and somebody shouts, fire, fire, I can't hear it? You know, what happens if a snake crawls on me and bites me? What's going to happen? Because your five senses, one of the things they do is give you protection. That's one of the reasons why sound is the last of the senses to turn off. Because even in the darkness we use sound to try and make sure there's no predator or enemy creeping up on us. No tiger, elephants, or some sort of burglar or thief coming. And so to give up sound, even cats can sleep, but they're always hearing. Because that's protection. So it's quite fearful to give up all what you think is protecting you. Your five senses, especially sight and sound. But that's one of the reasons why it's difficult to get into a jhana when you're not in a safe place. This place is safe. You've been here for a few days. I know Angulimala, the serial killer, became a monk, but I did ask earlier, there are no serial killers or psychopaths in this retreat. So no one's going to creep up behind you with a knife from the kitchen. You are safe. I should have mentioned that, because now I've put that in your brain. Now you're going to think about it, I'm sure. But to reassure you that, you know, after 40 years as a monk, you come across, there are some weird stuff I've witnessed and I know happened. And it's great being, you know, having been a scientist, being trained into being skeptical, always trying to find some other explanation rather than things supernatural. But sometimes you do see these things. And that's why it's really incredible when you see there's more to this life, you know, than many people think. And one of them is this monk I met years ago. He's dead now, so I never like to tell his name. His name was Sudamo. He was a monk from Indonesia. And you know, I think he ordained shortly after me, so it's my sort of generation. So I remember when I first saw him, in Wat Bawang, and I was with another monk, and I turned around straight away. I was sensitive. I said, wow, that monk has got power. He's really strong. You could feel it from him, because I was sensitive enough as well. And then sort of I went to talk to him, and his story, he was a Javanese Buddhist, a lay Buddhist, and he wanted not to be a monk at first, but to be like a rishi, like a hermit. Just go into the jungles, meditate, live by himself, and find the truth by himself. So he went off into the jungles of Java. This was about 40 years ago. And you can hardly find a jungle in Java these days. But, you know, it was very, very sort of, what you might call pristine 40 years ago. So he went into that jungle, found a nice place, sat down. And I remember him describing, now personally, he said that he was meditating there. And he said a star came right into him. And you know, he called it like a deva, like a heavenly being star. And he married, that's, you know, he's trying to use English, married, united with this star. And he said he had so much bliss. And it was such a long time. He didn't really know how long he was in this beautiful state. Now the star, you know, his nimittas came into him. He married it, just joined right into it. And was blissed out for quite a long time. He didn't know how long. But when he came out of his meditation in the jungle, he did notice the jungle had changed. There was lots of destruction, trees lying down. And he checked with the villagers what he suspected had happened. There had been a flood for many days. And where he sat, he would have been submerged under a couple of meters of water. For many days. Number one, he had no clue what was going on. He was just enjoying himself. And number two, not damaged at all, perfectly okay. Underwater for days, he was. Now that is, you know, the personal anecdote. And there's another personal, I know, there's other anecdotes. There's one from the suttas, the time of the Buddha, which the Buddha says, what happens to you when you get into jhanas? And I like telling this because it's funny. This was where a monk was in the forest meditating, got into a jhana, sitting perfectly still. And one of the things when you get into deep jhanas, even the ordinary jhanas, it's very hard to see you breathing because you're so still you don't need oxygen. And in a fourth jhana, you're not breathing at all. You don't need it. And so there you are for hours, sometimes days, not a breath going in, not a breath going out, perfectly healthy. So anyway, this monk was off in some jhana somewhere in the forest. When two villagers came past, and when they came past, they saw this monk sitting perfectly still. And they thought, he's dead. Now, if any of you get into one of these jhanas here, or if I get into a jhana here, I try not to when you're here, but I'll tell you why in a moment. Don't take me to the crematorium. The difference between a person who is dead and a person in jhana, no, this is fascinating, is if you're dead, you're cold. In a jhana, you're still warm. That's the only difference, and that's actually how you can tell whether the person is dead or just in deep meditation. Feel their body. And no, I don't know, I've been by next to loads of dead bodies, you know, doing funerals. You touch them, you know, they are cold. Not that they've come out of a freezer, but no, they're generally cold. And notice if your body temperature, what you think is body temperature, the same temperature as you, they're just in jhana, they're not dead. So anyway, they didn't know that, so these villagers thought he was dead. And they did the right thing. You know, they can't let the venerable be eaten by animals. They've got to cremate him. So they got some word from the forest. They're in the forest, and it didn't really take that long. Built a nice funeral pyre, put the monk on top, lit the fire, did some chant, whatever they knew. They chanted just, you know, for good luck. And once the fire was lit and everything was flaming away, they just went back on their business. Because, you know, you're busy life. You can't hang around a funeral all day. And the next morning, they were very impressed when the monk came in on arms round. The very same monk they'd cremated the day before. And not even his robes were charred. So, you know, if you did make a mistake, you forgot to test if I was in jhana and touched my body, oh, he's dead, let's take him to the crematorium. You took me to the crematorium, you put me inside the ovens, you turn on the gas and ignite it, and an hour or two later, when the guy opened up the coffin, hi, it's me again. That's what would happen, because in the jhanas, you're invulnerable. I don't know why that is. No, scientifically, but that is the truth of the matter. You can't be harmed. No, even physically. They can't do anything with you. So, I say that because, not here, but over in Sydney somewhere, there's all these stories. People like anecdotes. All these stories, there was a 9-day retreat, and a Vietnamese monk was teaching it. And he started, you know, like we start the retreats here, if everybody arrives on time, that is. You know, they arrived on Friday, so they started on Friday, not a bit on Saturday morning, a bit on Saturday afternoon. And anyway, just, you know, I'm cool with that, doesn't matter. So they all came on Friday afternoon, had their, you know, soup or whatever it is they had, the first little meal, orientation, showing where they are, all the rules of the retreat. And then they come into the hall, half an hour meditation, then the opening talk at 8 o'clock. That was the schedule. And so half an hour meditation, the monk was there, we'd start meditating now. After half an hour, the monk was still meditating. Another half an hour, 8:30, still meditating. 9 o'clock, hadn't come out of meditation yet. They were all waiting for a talk. 9:30, they didn't wait any longer, they all went to bed. And they left the monk there meditating. They got up in the morning for the morning chant, and the monk was still meditating there. 7 o'clock, they went for breakfast, the monk was still meditating there. They never got any talk at all. Because the monk just sat there for, I think, 8 days. Never moved, never went to the toilet, never had anything to eat, never said a word. That's what happens when you get into deep jhanas. You sit here. And when he did come out eventually, you know, the first thing he did was to apologize. So, I'm really sorry, but, you know, I just got into this meditation. I couldn't stop myself. And I haven't given you any talks, no instructions. No, I apologize for that. And all the people say, no, that's wonderful. That's inspiring. It's so rare to see that actually happen in front of us. Thank you so much. Because you know, sometimes that's the most inspiring thing at all, of all, to see that it's possible, that you can see it in front of your eyes that these things occur. So everyone was so happy about that retreat. You see, it can be done. It is being done, even today. Because that's why some people ask you, you know, can you still get jhanas these days? Can you still get enlightened these days? Well, you see, actually, happily, that really gives you a lot of confidence. In the time of the Buddha, you may be, people think in the time of the Buddha, people were special. You know, but no, people are the same today as they were in the time of the Buddha. They could, you could. So that was inspiring to actually to see that. I mention those stories, not just to entertain you, but to take away your fear. So if you do start getting really deep into the meditation, don't think that something's going to go wrong. Don't be afraid, you know, of losing your safety mechanisms, of like hearing. You are totally even more safe than people outside of jhanas. You're invulnerable, special. Again, I also mentioned the health benefits, huge health benefits afterwards. You know, sometimes diseases just can't stand that type of power. They're just zapped, gone. You can, sometimes when you do get into deep meditation, you can actually feel that power. You know, you can say, if you really wanted to, you can do almost anything. You can feel the power of the mind when it's still energized, huge amounts of energy. Whatever you really want to turn it to, you can. And you can actually feel that as an experience. So this is what happens when you get into those deep meditations. And then afterwards, you know it's been a deep meditation, a jhana, because afterwards you are blissed out. You are just walking on air. You are just a happy little person. You don't care whether you eat or don't eat. You don't care what you eat. Anything. And again, it can be raining. You don't mind getting wet. You don't mind getting cold. You don't mind anything. So the biggest experience of your life. You're just happy as can be. And that is where you start learning about Buddhism. Tomorrow maybe I'll talk about insights. It's not just for the bliss of this. It's for the data, the experiences which you get from these deep states of mind really make the teachings of the Buddha just so clear. You missed it before, you just can't see it before. Once you get these types of experiences, everything which you heard now really does make sense. It's a powerful, powerful, powerful teaching. Now we're talking a little bit about Christianity and other religions yesterday, and sometimes I can be a bit mean. But once you actually, to other religions, but once you get into these states of mind, you come out afterwards, it's just obvious just how incredible these teachings of the Buddha are. Once you get these types of experiences, you can never be, excuse me, a Christian or a Muslim again. These are too powerful, too truth. This is personal experience. Powerful stuff. And that is what gets you enlightened. And that is why you're here. Blissing out. And it's a beautiful path of enlightenment. Bliss out. Have the time of your life and get enlightened at the same time. Isn't that a good marketing? So that when these things happen, the nimittas, they're like, oh, the other thing I should actually say about nimittas. The first time a nimitta comes up, you think you're imagining it. I don't know how many times in interviews, which are going to happen soon, how many times I saw a light, but it couldn't be a nimitta. I wasn't peaceful enough. And I asked, what were you doing? What happened? And I say, that was a nimitta. You know, one of the early nimitta, not the big strong ones, but it's a nimitta. And it's because people have this terrible doubt. They think, not me, you know, I've only just, this is my first retreat, you know, I haven't been looking after the Buddhist Fellowship or the Brahm Center for so many years, and I'm not sort of this devout Buddhist, you know, I haven't done much meditation or done much for anybody, it can't be me, but it is. So this is why I say that if you imagine or if you think you've got a limiter, right now the score rate is about 95% that it is a limiter. The chances are it is. Sometimes you think, no, it's just I see the sunlight, that's all. The sunlight is, you see, see how these high windows? That this is, I designed this place. That is one of the reasons I put these windows high up. So it can't be the sun coming through the window. It can't be a headlight of a car. Can't be. There's no headlights in here. There's no cars in here. And the windows are too high. And this is not on a flight path. Singapore Airlines do not fly over Jarnia Grove. It can't be the landing lights of a Boeing. So if you see a limiter in here, it's a real one. Wow. And that gets you excited. Me? I got a limiter? Why can't you be excited about that? You deserve it. You're good people. And you've got a good teacher. What do you expect? So you have a nice time. So if one comes up, just believe it. Take it for granted. Chances are it really is a limiter. So don't say, I can't be, and just get rid of it. Get into it. Enjoy it. And see if by following this method, letting go, not wanting anything, present moment awareness, never forget that, not wanting, not thinking, your mind builds up energy, gets more and more powerful, limiters, they come up, and you have a wonderful time. And who knows, maybe you might get into a jhana. And the last thing about these jhanas, if I've known you for a long time, then I've got a good idea of, you know, your practice, your mind. And, you know, you can tell, you know, you've got a good chance. You know, that sometimes people come on these retreats and I've never seen them before. And I think about a year ago, this guy came on this retreat, Australian, with tattoos all over him. And even I make stupid mistakes. You know, I thought, if you come to the right place... You know, are you visiting one of your friends up in the prison up the road? Because it was stereotyping, and that's, you shouldn't do that, that's wrong. You know, this guy, tats all over him, you know, really like one of these really tough guys, like a bikie. You know, like these Hell's Angels. That's what he looked like. And he came in here and did a retreat. And he was the one who got the jhanas. I couldn't believe it. You know, he came in front of me, and I was very skeptical. You know, this is my fault, okay, I shouldn't do that. I should be more open and more wise and to judge people like that. But this is what I did, and he came and he told me what had happened. It's beautiful light, he got into the light. And I was looking, I was like, look at you. And he described it, and I know what I'm talking about. When you come up to me and you say these things, if it's a jhana, I'll know it. If it is not, I will know that too. So you can't fool me. I've got too much experience. And so he came up to me and said, crikey, that's it. You've got a jhana. That really inspired me afterwards. That, you know, a person who hadn't much experience, hadn't really done very much, but he was actually a really nice guy. I found out afterwards, and it's obvious he had to be. And even he could sort of get this jhana. Wow. And that reaffirmed that any one of you here can get the jhanas. I really mean it, any one of you. Just press the letting go button. Just do it right. Follow the instructions. And these things happen. And you don't just make yourself happy. You make me really happy. Because when I know what you've got, wow. And these jhanas, it's Samma Samadhi, the last factor of the Eightfold Path, you've done. And I also want to inspire you because in the suttas, they said that this is standing in the footsteps of the Buddha. You're experiencing what the Buddha experienced. Absolutely no difference at all. Jhana is jhana is jhana. You haven't got a jhana for women, jhana for men, jhana for gays. It's all the same. You haven't got a jhana for Singaporeans and one for Malaysians. Exactly the same. The jhana you experience, if you get there, is precisely the same, no different in one iota to the jhana of the Buddha experience under the Bodhi tree. You have got the mind of a Buddha. And when I realized that, even now, goosebumps all over. You know what the Buddha felt like. This is so much so that they call the happiness of those jhanas in the suttas, they call it sambodhi sukha, the happiness of enlightenment. It's not enlightenment, but it's so close. You're actually getting a real, real taste of enlightenment and what it feels like to be a Buddha, to be an enlightened one. Personal experience of what it's like. Wow. These aren't sort of talks anymore, not ideas. Direct experience of feeling what it's like to be a Buddha. The enlightenment happiness. Wow. And you can do that this morning. The doors are open for that. That's spooky. That's exciting. Wow. Ooh. But it's true. Most of you won't do it. Not on this retreat. But some of you will. And most of you will eventually. That's why it's fortunate to have been with a teacher like Ajahn Chah, who taught it was possible. Yeah, you can do it. Go for it. And because of that, you did. And now I do the same for you. You can. Go for it. And it happens. Wow. If you see anybody in jhanas or come out after us, please treat them carefully. They're just so sensitive afterwards, so high. I always remember this one guy after a 3 o'clock meditation in our city centre in Perth. You know, this usually in Perth every Saturday afternoon we give a meditation session. And it finishes about 4:15. Ring the bell about 4 o'clock. Questions and answers till 4:15. He was meditating all through the questions and answers. And afterwards, you know, I tell people in Perth, any questions? No one ask any questions. So I ring the bell, we bow. And there's a whole line of people asking their questions. And it takes another half an hour before I get out. And he was still sitting there. Perfectly still. And I looked at him and knew what he was doing. And so I never actually told her this, but I'm very proud of her. She's obviously listened to me a lot. Our caretaker in Nolamara Temple, Lynn, she just sat in the back waiting for him to come out. She also knew what he was doing, getting into a jhana. And when he came out, she gently led him to another room. Sit here for a while. Just so you can actually just come out gently. Instead of going into the room with so many talkative, busy people. And I really, really thought, well done, Lynn. You know, you understand what this is like. Very, very peaceful, so still. And if you come out and even listen to a talk like this, it grates you. You've been so sensitive, so still, so peaceful. So much joy. You know, it's hard to come out. So come out slowly and gently. So see someone sitting for long periods of time. After just lead them gently to their room and just sit them down in there. And if they've meditated, they've missed lunch, you've got full permission from me and from all to go and make them something and give it to them any time of the day or night if they've had a nice jhana. Forget the 8 precepts. The 8 precepts are there for your meditation, not the other way around. A lot of times they are not hungry. So those are the beautiful meditations. Are you inspired? Inspiration is not enough, remember. Remember how to do it. No wanting, in the moment, and have a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful time. That is why I teach. For the people who experience that. Basically. And you eventually will. Okay. Sadhu. Very good. An announcement for the BF, because Angie's leaving this afternoon. What is that? That's my talk. Yeah, okay. I'm going to give a talk next month, for those of you who haven't had enough of me. I'll be back.
We might have a poster out there. I can go the religion itself, that the known and right knows. That's the whole point of Brahm Center being set up, to provide the wisdom and the mindfulness practice without the religion. When people are ready, then you come to work them. But that's not that the, it's not like we're trying to convert people, but rather if we can bring the wisdom and the practice of meditation to more people out there, you will only benefit from that. I've just received an email that said that a boy in Brussels institution has just committed suicide. A couple months ago, and I heard another one, which was another junior college. Last year, 422 people committed suicide in Singapore. A third, almost a quarter of them, 100 of them, were below years 30 of age. So, although we're affluent, we are very blessed in Singapore with all the materialism, but the mental health is something that we have to be watchful about. Suicide in schools are not very much talked about. Last year on 1st April 2003, a boy in my kid's school thought out committed suicide. He hanged himself in the doorknob. It's not difficult for them to take their lives. So, as part of our Buddhist practice is to have the compassion, the willingness to go out there and serve, bring the wisdom, bring the practice into the schools. And we're able to do that because Brahm Center is secular. So I'm very grateful to Ajahn for supporting this, this charity and to lend his name. So the other things that we're doing as well to outreach to the elderly, because many elderly are very lonely. They also have strained relationships.
I'm old.
Strained relationships with their loved ones. I think some of you are already befriended. We work alongside the hospitals, Kutik, Wat, Changi, and Tantoksin, Rilisum, to match the befriended who are trained with the elderly so that you can actually go and share with them and cheer and hopefully bring some dharma. The ultimate aim is to try to help them repair their relationships back with their loved ones and hopefully before they die. There are many Rimke nursing home patients, if you ever go and visit them, they just lie in the bed right across the hallway. Hardly any of the relatives come and visit them. They're like their family. So while we have volunteers to go there and visit them, what they would wish most is their own children to come and visit them. And we're trying to devise a program to see how we can get their children back into their lives, or at least their, some form of relatives back into their lives before they have to die with such loneliness. So these are things that we can do as a service, and I think it's also an act of our compassion. So do come down and sign up as a volunteer. Just send us an email. But if you also know people who are in need of help, like counseling, you can also send them to Brahm Center. For those who can't afford it, it's free. For those who can, it's only $10. And that's just to put value to the service our counselors offer. So I took some pictures. I'll be posted on the Buddhist Fellowship Singapore groups page. Those of you may not know, there's an unofficial group that's Friends of Buddhist Fellowship, and there's an official page which Buddhist Fellowship posts its programs, so you can get the photos of it. And if anyone likes to volunteer for the November 10th seminar that I know, just send me an email at andrew@brahmcenter.com.
I'm volunteer.
But one of the reasons we are selling tickets by donation is also to raise funds. Now we have a psychologist on our team, and that is to help reach out to these young people, because I mean, they come to someone like me and they look at me like I remind them of their mom. Not that young anymore. So a psychologist in their 20s, it's easier for them to relate to and give them a sense of, okay, you probably understand me better than this older guy or this older woman. And also for us to develop. So there'll be also a mindful youth camp
Mm-hmm.